How have you thrown away your life?
How have I thrown away my life? 13 years of my old job, I feel like in a lot of ways was a throwaway, doing meaningless work for people that I didn't. I mean, my employers were okay, but most of the people I worked on behalf of, like going into manufacturing facilities, it's a waste of time. I wasn't doing anything to better the world.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Chris Latray about his book, One Sentence Journal, Short Poems and Essays from the World at Large. Okay, 2 points. There's an intersection here of both where this book project takes off in terms of leaving your job and also the search for meaning. Where do you want to start?
Didn't I say you had the tiller and I was just going to row?
I want you to read the first paragraph of the book then.
Okay. I'm not certain where the idea for starting a one-sentence journal originally came from. I know it isn't an original idea. I probably stumbled across someone else doing it online, thought it was cool, and decided to give it a whirl. All I know is that at some point on Monday, July 1st, 2013, I opened up my notebook and wrote, July 1st, 2013, I found myself in the company of James Lee Burke while waiting for a tire repair at Les Schwab. That's the first paragraph.
You have 4 epigraphs in the book, including one by James Lee Burke, in which he asks, how do you explain to yourself the casual manner in which you threw away your life?
Right.
So you were at this job doing something, paper pushing, traveling.
I was a manufacturing consultant, so there was some paper pushing in the form of like technical writing where I was writing manuals for people, as well as, you know, hands-on technical stuff and a lot of travel.
And then you started writing these one sentences.
Well, that was just an exercise in wanting to write more. So, you know, the idea of writers needing to keep a journal, that's one of those things with a capital T that writers are supposed to do, and I was terrible at it. But I thought, you know, I mean, I carry these little field notes, notebooks, and I use them for work. And then I think by accident one day I just kind of wrote something down, and then, like I said, somewhere I stumbled across the one-sentence journal as a daily practice. And it just became, you know, sentences are the bread and butter of a writer. And if you're even going so far as to just practice writing one good sentence, and they aren't all good, I felt like that was doing something, you know, that I could do anywhere.
And the book is called One Sentence Journal, Short Poems and Essays from the World at Large. And when I was sitting with the sentence portion, they're shaped like poems, meaning that they have intentional line breaks. And they read both like observations and aphorisms or sayings. I felt like I was reading a cross between Grumpy Old Men and an Audubon Society catalog.
Yeah.
But I want to give, here are 2 examples. One of your observations is, 2 young girls on a toboggan are dragged madly down the snowy street by a pair of gangly, rambunctious dogs with tongues spilling and bouncing through the wild grins on their faces. And then that's couched with, just because there's no shade doesn't mean you're out of the woods. What can you say about your range?
Well, I mean, they're not necessarily in chronological order, you know? So obviously every day, and they weren't originally in poem format. That came later. So originally they were actually just sentences. So some days are good, some days are bad. Some days the coolest, most hilarious thing are these neighbor kids getting dragged on a toboggan by their wild dogs. And that catches your eye. And I just thought it was hilarious, you know? So that becomes the thing I write about. Other days, you know, it's the end of the day. And whether I'm at home or I'm sitting in some hotel somewhere, just kind of not in the best frame of mind, you get something else, you know?
Like, for instance, will you read one of your sentences relating to that?
Yeah, fat, lazy, grouchy, and prone in a hotel room. Yeah. So like one of my favorite like road stories is because, you know, when you have an expense account and you have a tendency to make poor choices, you eat a lot of really bad food because you can. So like I remember one time just gorging myself on pizza somewhere and then going to my hotel room and watching on my laptop From Dusk Till Dawn, which is this Quentin Tarantino horror movie. And in the very early scenes of the movie, they've kidnapped this family in a Winnebago and they're in this seedy motel. And one of the characters goes out for just this greasy bag of like drive-in cheeseburgers, you know, the really small, gross, delicious kind. And all of a sudden, even though I'm just stuffed, I just started craving cheeseburgers. And I remembered there was one right outside the hotel. And after about 30 minutes, it's like, beep it. And off I went to get these cheeseburgers. And I gorged myself further. And then that's how you end up with fat, lazy, grouchy, and prone in a motel room. I don't know if I wrote that as a response to that, but that's the type of thing that would generate just my own bad choices and feeling terrible about them.
Right, which leads me to another one of your pieces. Will you read page 130?
I know there is an unspoken rule that holidays are a time to maybe dress up a little, but tomorrow, when I prepare to leave for my mom's house to indulge in a Thanksgiving feast, I will pay her cooking my highest compliment by dressing in sweatpants. Yes.
So let's talk about your sense of humor.
Okay.
Have you always had it?
I
Were you
think
born
so.
with
I
it?
think so.
Did anyone else in your family have it?
My mom does. My dad did. I think my sisters, I don't know, you know, as a kid, I spent a lot of time by myself. So I don't really remember the yucks coming fast and loose in my family, at least, you know, with my sisters and stuff. They're, you know, when we get together, or when we used to get together, which we're a little spread out now, we would always bring up things and it was a laugh riot. But yeah,
How do you think it serves you in the world?
I think it just, see, that's the thing with humor that I worry that a lot of people don't get in the literary community. So particularly in literary fiction, there's just such an overwhelming onslaught of sadness and misery in a lot of fiction being written, devoid of humor. And I see that a lot. And the thing is that no matter how bad things are, funny stuff happens and people find ways to laugh. And just hilarious things happen in the middle of the worst circumstances. And I always refer people just to reservation life. You know, my native friends are some of the funniest people I know, and yet come from communities just eyebrow deep in sadness, you know? So humor is just, it's just a critical part of the human condition, I think.
Absolutely. I was thinking about, I went to your book release here in Missoula, Montana, and you had this non-traditional way. You basically said, I'm not going to do a reading because readings are kind of boring. But you did this amazing presentation where you had photographs, a PowerPoint. You were
It was
incorporating
actually a keynote.
Okay,
It was
thank
an
you.
Apple product.
Thank you for. And you were reading other people's poems like Ted Kooser and Jim Harrison,
Melissa
Melissa
Milchrist.
Milchrist. And I'm just thinking about why that instinct?
Well, I come primarily from a rock and roll background. Like when I was in high school, I was going to become a rock star, and my friends and I moved to Seattle. This is the kind of late mid 80s. 86 is when we went there. And then I was going to write books on the side, you know, and now it's kind of flip-flopped. I still play loud rock music, but that's become the side thing. And, you know, we've never been a cover band yet. There's always, depending on how long our set is, we'll drop one or two covers from other bands that are influences or things that we like in one way or another. And I just, you know, why shouldn't we? You know, if this book exists because of the work of, you know, Jim Harrison in particular, and a book that Harrison and Ted Kooser did together specifically, why not cover their work a little bit when I'm doing my own thing? That's what it's totally based on.
Yeah, and I also noticed in the book it's very generous in its acknowledgments. You know, like you really pay mind at the beginning and the end of the book to honor where you've come from and who's helped you.
Mm-hmm.
Why lend a hand like that? Or,
well, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing without these people that I acknowledge. You know, I don't consider what I do to be anything original at all, other than they're my own thoughts, you know. But I think my book is a kind of a weird hybrid that you don't see so much, that hopefully will change a little bit. But I'm not doing anything original, you know. I'm doing my best to do whatever I'm doing well, but it's all, you know, whether you want to refer to it as trails having already been blazed or standing on the shoulders of giants, whatever metaphor you want to use, that's what I'm doing.
At what point in the process did you know it could become a book?
When I read Braided Creek, yeah. A Conversation in Poetry by Jim Harrison and Ted Kooser, which is, Kooser was recovering from cancer treatment, and he started writing these short poems and sending postcards to Harrison, who would reciprocate. And then Copper Canyon collected that in a little book, and it doesn't identify who wrote what. And their observations in these little 2 to 8 line poems, when I was looking at my sentences, I thought, you know, this isn't so different than what I'm doing, because there was nature reflections, there was men aging reflections, all the type of stuff that I was doing in my sentences. And that's when I realized, hey, you know, if I chop these into little poems, I might have something here. So that was the genesis for wanting to see what I could do with it.
And then you incorporate these longer prose pieces. Mm-hmm. Had you been working on those simultaneously, or did they come forward later?
They were stuff that I was doing along the way as well. You know, some of them started out in maybe different forms, like as blog posts on my website, things like that. Like some of the travel observations where I would write, because it was something to do when I was traveling. You know, you can only eat so much pizza and cheeseburgers, right?
And watch so much Lifetime TV.
That's right.
In terms of the prose, some of the titles include Primal Saunter, Creekside Drama, My Own Private Arsenal, where you detail your gun collection, and Notes on the Sacred Art of Dog Walking, which you mention is after Jim Harrison's Notes on the Sacred Art of Log Sitting, mm-hmm. which is a poem. And the book also circles loss, mm-hmm. the loss of your father and Darla the adventure dog.
Yes.
Can we talk about her? How did she come to you? Yeah.
It's still really hard to talk about her. She moved north from Tucson with my wife as a puppy riding on the dashboard of a rental truck. And I didn't really, she was one of 3 Russells. And, you know, our relationship didn't really take off until she was the last dog.
Yeah. In the book, you make note that you intended to give her sort of a, like, last great experiences in the outdoors together, the two of you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite memory with her?
Not specific, you know, it's a collection of memories, I guess.
Yeah.
Just all the time we spent at Council Grove. I don't think there's any one particular that comes immediately to mind.
Why'd you name her Darla?
I didn't name her. She was already named.
She came with the name.
Yeah, yeah. So,
did you approve of the name?
I do approve of the name, yeah. Yeah, so she was Julia's dog. So Julia had this dog named Orly, who was also a Russell. He was the oldest. And when I met her, she had a Russell named Haas, who was killed. And she got a rescue dog named Velcro, who was also a Russell, but was just a whack job and didn't get along with Orly. And then she got a call from the same people where Haas had come from. So Darla was Haas's sister, you know, from a different litter, right? And so she got Darla like a year before she moved up to Montana. So she was originally Julia's dog. And, you know, she was our dog. But, you know, at that point when I started taking her out all the time, you know, we developed a pretty tight relationship, you know, as, you know, dogs do when you're the one who spends the most time outdoors with them, you know.
Will you read a sentence about Darla? I'll let you choose.
My little dog and I were out in all weather, rain, snow, heat, mud. The sketchier the weather, the better, because no one else would be out. Darla loved wading into the river at various access spots, regardless of season, and being low to the ground. That meant she was pretty much horribly filthy all the time. She would interact with other people only enough so that they were aware of how cute she was. Then she'd be on about her business. She rarely engaged with other dogs at all, and then only small ones. If she was uncertain, she made a point to hide herself behind me, which made me feel big and tough and protective, which was great for my ego. The only time she got riled up was if large puppies tried to engage with her, usually labs or some other gangly, obnoxious breed, and they invaded her space. More than once I saw her snarl, ready to fight. Thankfully, she was easy to scoop up and carry away before anyone got hurt. Plus, by that point, she didn't have enough teeth left to savage anyone with anyway.
How old was she?
Oh, she was, 2000... 16, she was 13 or 14 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Chris Latray about his book, One Sentence Journal, Short Poems and Essays from the World at Large. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. There's some adult language in this half. Listener discretion is advised. Chris, in addition to being a musician, you're also a photographer. And I want you to talk about the art of the book. There are illustrations on the inside, and mm-hmm. I'm assuming that's your photograph on the cover?
Yes, and on the back.
Tell me how that came to be in terms of choosing illustrations and who the artist is. And
well, the illustrations are by Mara Ponich Crouch, who is a good friend of mine, who is the manager of Fact and Fiction, where I work part-time. And I had seen her stuff, and I'd seen other stuff, other books, you know, poetry collections or whatever with illustrations in them, and I thought it was cool. And I just thought it would be a neat way to just kind of mix it up a little bit. Only a couple of them, I think, were written specifically for this. Others were ones that she just had. And then as far as the photographs, when I started working with my friend Aaron Draplin, who did the cover design, I just kind of threw him some images, and he started doing his thing with them, and that's just kind of how it worked out. I mean, I love this photograph that's on the cover. It's Morrell Creek, which is just looking downstream from Morrell Falls up by Sealy Lake on a Memorial Day when it was kind of – the water was running really high. So people say it looks like the opening scene in The Revenant, which I think is kind of cool too because it actually sort of does.
I remember the last time I saw you, you were just about to go speak to a group of students, elementary school students. Mm-hmm. Did you impart some wisdom upon them?
I don't know what wisdom I imparted on them, but they certainly made an impression on me. This was the sixth grade class of Jillian Kessler, who is a teacher at the international school, invited me to come up. And we would walk around and then like for 5 minutes, and then she'd say, okay, everybody write a sentence about something that you experienced or whatever. And I mean, those kids, you know, I didn't know. I was kind of scared going up there because I've never done anything like that before. But just what they just kind of pulled out of the universe and related just like that, you know, I was really impressed. It was a cool experience.
Were you a creative middle schooler?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, I have a little one of those blank notebooks when they first started coming out from eighth grade where I won the reading award for eighth grade graduation, you know, and my teacher, Deanna Parker, who taught at Frenchtown for years, she was both my third grade teacher and then in junior high as well, you know, said, this is for you to start your first fantasy novel, because I was a big into fantasy back then, you know. In fact, she told my parents to buy me the Dune trilogy, which is sci-fi, but you know, that was a big deal for me, was reading those books, you know. I mean, that's, I don't know that you necessarily see it in this book, but you know, all the Tolkien and Robert E. Howard's Conan books and all that fantasy stuff is really what taught me to love stories and want to read and then ultimately want to write, though I kind of went off in a different direction as far as what I write. But I bristle when people talk about, oh, you know, kids these days, all they read is Harry Potter and they don't read this and they don't read that. And whatever opens the door, man, let them go. Because I know, in fact, a couple of the events I've done where I've talked about that, I've had people come up to me and say, oh, that's the same thing for me. You know, I started reading The Lord of the Rings or Jack London, you know, stuff like that.
And one of the things I so appreciate about your book is your search for meaning. And I just want you to talk about why does it matter to you that your life has meaning or purpose?
I just, you know, we're given so little time with our lives. And I don't know if it's so much about meaning or it's just wanting to make the best use of the time possible, you know. I don't want to be someone stuck on a couch watching TV, you know, get up and go to work and then come home and drink a six-pack of beer and watch TV or have a, you know, a list of 500 shows that I still have to catch up on, you know, just stuff like that. To me, you know, when I took the job, it was based in Ohio, and I had, you know, I'd gone to Washington, come back to Montana, and then ended up moving to Ohio for 3 years. And I thought of all the places around here that were at my fingertips that I didn't take advantage of, you know, like standing waist deep in Rock Creek. I mean, you're a fisher person. You know what that's like. Yeah. There are people around the world that their life's dream is to come here and do the things that we could, you know.
We'd go
do it right now, you know. And there are people saving and pinching and scraping to come and do what we can do anytime we want. And it's more about that. It's more about, you know, living a full life than it is about necessarily finding any particular meaning. I mean, I reflect a lot, but it's more as a result of just wanting to make sure that I'm making best use of my time. But at the same time, I fail a lot too. You know, it's not... Mara told me, you know, if I didn't know you, I'd hate you because of, you know, you meditate and you do yoga and all that stuff that makes it sound like one of these perfect life Instagram post lives. And it isn't that at all.
Right.
You know, I am a raging flood of isms and all these not particularly kind feelings and emotions that flare up inside me that I have to manage every moment of every day. So I'm not just floating through life, you know?
On a magic carpet.
Exactly.
I want you to read the sentence that starts with too many people, and then I want you to talk about your yoga practice.
Too many people with too much hardship while plenty of others need to experience some biblical calamity.
Is that the grumpy version of you?
That's the post-2016 election version of me.
I see. Yeah. And so you've copped to doing yoga. You're a yogi.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to do yoga and what does it do for you?
Well, it was something, because I used to lift weights a lot, you know. So I've always been kind of a person that likes to work out and do that kind of thing. And Julia used to do yoga, and I'd always said, oh, some, you know, because you would start out with these 30-day challenges where you get like an introductory rate. It's like the first one's free, and then you're hooked, you know. And so I'd always said I would do a 30-day challenge with her and ultimately had to live up to that. And I actually started the day before my dad passed away. And I kept doing it as a means to, okay, everybody says this is going to change your life and it's a good way to deal with trauma in your emotional life and all these things. And I thought, let's see if this is legit or not. And it has been very helpful. I'm, you know, if I told the new person next to me that I've been doing it 4 years and 3 weeks later, they've surpassed my ability to actually achieve the final expression of any of the postures, it's it's really hard for me, but, you know, I keep doing it.
Which leads me to my last favorite sentence from the book. Will you read It Remains, The Strangest Things?
I think you should read it.
It remains among the strangest things to me how the body feels differently from day to day, as the one I inhabited this morning seemed a superior model to the one I last tried to navigate a yoga class in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aging is the worst.
Uh-huh.
But it's also okay, too. How do you want to live your best life now?
Slowly. You know, I mean, the older you get, the faster time seems to go. You know, I remember as a kid, the summer just seemed endless. And this is a common lament for everybody. But I don't, you know, there are things, having left my old job, that literally I would rather live in my car than have to give another inch of ground, you know. And as far as letting the ideas of what we're supposed to achieve in our lives, which are typically economic, you know, the ideas that we're kind of force-fed right out of the gate. I mean, kids now, the things that, you know, like my friends who have young children, that, and, you know, their lives revolve around taking their children from one event to the next, to this, to that, to the other thing. I didn't have that, and I don't feel that I'm any worse off for it. I think I'm better than off for having, I almost said better than, I don't mean better than, better off for having not had so much activity, because I had to learn how to entertain myself and how to live in my own head, you know? And I just find quiet and just keeping the stress down, not saying yes to too many things, which continues to still be a problem for me, you know? But yeah, I want to be the guy that sits on a chair by a river and spends the day that way, then comes home and says, yeah, you know, I summited 5 teeners and blah, blah, blah by lunch. And then, you know, whatever. Have at it. That's not for me.
Yeah. I'll meet you at the river.
Yeah.
Chris Latray is a writer, walker, photographer, bookseller, rock star, and freelance everything. He's an enrolled member of Montana's Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bo Baker, studio engineer and production assistant.
You've been listening to Quadrillion by American Falcon.